Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker football podcast. If you missed the news last week, this season's episodes are sponsored by BetBall and we'll be putting our predictions of all the games on the BetBall app at the end of the podcast. Go to the link in the description, download the app, get involved. Although we should warn you that I think our accumulator last week, only one thing was correct and that was Liverpool winning. But there was no red card in the Burnley game, although Sam, and that introduces my first guest of the Squawker Talker, Sam Long. This is how I will introduce you now each week, is I will tell you off for the wrong predictions that you gave me.
He misrepresented you.
Yes.
Sorry, yeah, it was a bit rogue.
I said there's going to be yellows, and you decided red.
Creative license.
Creative license. So that was Sam's fault, who is on this week, so we'll be keeping him to a tighter leash, I think. RE the predictions afterwards. Will, you are the reason for our correct prediction.
Also, yeah, and if I'm being generous, I predicted the two goal scorers as well.
Yes.
Because I said, I think let's ignore the Robertson cross, yeah. Which didn't happen. I said, Firmino Mane, goal scorer.
Oh, he's remembered the tone he said it in as well. But that didn't.
Which kind of sounds like I'm saying Firmino or Mane.
Yeah.
But I cleverly
disguised
didn't
it.
Use... create room for ambiguity in terms of the connective between those two. So it equally could have been and, in which case I would have predicted both goal scorers.
There you go. Well, this week we're going to be asking Will to predict every single Premier League goal scorer
and
this weekend.
If you'd asked me who would score for Southampton, I would have said Danny Ings, just for the record.
Exactly.
Would have said.
He would have said. And someone that would have said a lot of things, that was straight out of the Mohamed Butt textbook, that prediction, Will.
I'm learning.
I did correctly predict four results last week.
I know.
Actually, as it turns out.
Four scorelines.
Everton, Liverpool... two other ones. Norwich, I think. I can't remember. No, Norwich.
It was pretty good results wise as well, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, it was all right. It wasn't bad. I was quite surprised.
Was it? No, but was it like 9 out of 10?
I think maybe 9 or 8. I can't remember exactly.
Well, there you go.
This is incidentally for his article.
Yes. For the predictions, the Premier League predictions article on Squawker.com. Check it out. It's good stuff.
Well, there you go. Mo, and despite me being a bit naughty there, Mo did actually do pretty well on those predictions. So we'll probably be leaning on him more for the actual bet at the end. But as I said, BetBall all season long, if you're 18 plus and you're gambling aware, which you please must do, download the app and that will be in the description. But we'll move straight on to diving into this week's football. And there is only one place to start, and I think I say that every week, but there always is one place. We make sure that there's only one place to start because we've all gone head first into Liverpool versus Arsenal. That will be the game we're previewing first. To set the scene, I found a few The Last Time stats relating to Arsenal's woeful form, not only against Liverpool, but against Big Six sides in the Premier League. The last time they beat a Big Six side away from home in the Premier League was January 2015. And that was Man City, 2-0 win. And the last time they beat Liverpool in any game was a 4-1 league win at the Emirates in April 2015. So
that
4 years down the line.
That win against Man City, I can't remember if this is true, but I vaguely recall that being sort of seen as a watershed moment where Wenger was finally pragmatic in a game against a Big Six rival. It was meant to lead to like a sort of a better record in those sort of away games.
How wrong
just completely hasn't.
Everyone was. And the reason why, and this is the first point of topic of the Liverpool-Arsenal game, so obviously, and I should say for Liverpool as well, have not lost a game at Anfield for 42 games in the Premier League. Sam Allardyce's Crystal Palace still through it. So it's stacked against Arsenal. But the last time they did beat a big side, there was a little Spanish midfielder, magician even, in the middle of the pitch, doing a little dance after putting in a free kick and Olivier Giroud scoring, I believe, named Santi Cazorla. And after Arsenal's win against Burnley, Mo, have they got him back?
Oh, well, I mean, he's a bit more handsome. He's got a beard, but not quite as nice. So maybe. A little bit. A different version. A new twist. A sequel.
A new twist.
Will.
A sequel.
An edgy Cazorla. A gritty reboot.
Edgelord Cazorla. Yeah, gritty reboot Cazorla. Yeah,
and
there you go.
And we should, in case you haven't guessed, we're talking about Dani Ceballos, who on loan from Real Madrid made his full Premier League debut against Burnley and pretty much dominated every stat line possible in that game, providing two assists despite one being sort of a dodgy corner that Lacazette managed to get under his control and then turn in, and the other one was almost a tackle first,
It was a tackle.
It was a tackle pass, and Aubameyang weaved through and finished it. But is this the man that Arsenal needed to finally get a result with Big Six Size Mo? Is this going to be decisive at Anfield? Can they end that streak and end their own bad streaks in the process?
I mean, well, that's a bloody question. Let's bring it all back to the first bit. Is he the guy that's going to change Arsenal's fortunes against Big Six teams? Yes, because the big thing about Arsenal, one of the main things about Arsenal in big games is their midfield is just, it's wafer thin. You can either plow through it physically, like just like Pogba does, for example, or you can just pass around them and they'll chase after you well enough and they'll press hard, but it's never really organized, sustained enough to actually threaten anyone. And more to the point, when you press them, they can't handle it. Then Xhaka is a magnificent passer of the ball, but he doesn't have the mobility to escape the press. Mm-hmm. Lucas Torreira is dogged and tenacious. Okay, fair enough. But Guendouzi's too young. He doesn't really have the experience you would want. They're just too easy to press, right? But Danny Ceballos is not. You can't press him. He's obscenely good. He's got 5 of 5 dribbles completed this season, mm-hmm. right? Perfect. And he's got 2 of 2 tackles. He's created 3 chances. Those, by the way, are all highs for not just Arsenal this season, but also Liverpool midfielders as well. So Arsenal midfielders, Arsenal players in general, and Liverpool midfielders as well. He's a phenomenal player. Like, again, I've said this before many times, the idea that Real Madrid didn't want this guy is just utterly ludicrous. Mm. And he's so, so good. And Premier League fans, because he's gone to Arsenal on loan, and it's like, no one's really... I don't know if anyone's taking him seriously yet. They should take him seriously because Danny Ceballos is the business. Mm. He's going to be... He's edgelord Cazorla. He's here to tear... And whatever else happens in that game, and I do think... I'll get to that in a second.
Yeah.
He will dominate midfield. He will boss midfield. Liverpool will not be able to lay a glove on him. Fabinho will try, maybe kick him around a bit. He's a good diver as well, by the way, just as FYI. So
a good foul winner, I believe, correct term.
Yeah. So don't be surprised if he wins a few tasty ones off of Milner if he plays off Fabinho. Mm. If Milner plays, Milner's been dribbled past like 4 times already this season. If Ceballos versus Milner is going to be brutal. Yeah. I mean, you know, Milner is the king of getting nutmegged, as we all know. So
let that not be his legacy. Yeah.
Poor James Milner.
Nutmegged in the bleep test. That's James Milner's legacy.
Remember, James Milner is still on the streak of the record Premier League streak of if scores, he doesn't lose. Mm. That's another 40 game thing. So if Milner gets on the score sheet, look out for that to be broken as well. Yeah. But in relation to Danny Ceballos there, obviously you've said it gives them something completely new. And I think when they signed him, we were talking about how he offers that sort of foul-winning ability, but mm-hmm. just the presence in midfield to receive it with back to goal and actually turn and not be swamped by a Liverpool team that seems, again, as you said, I think highlighting midfield there is another key point. Because a Liverpool team that haven't looked defensively that solid themselves, however... that's because they seem to be going further back up the pitch. That seems to be the general analysis of it, is that at least the defensive line is higher. So Arsenal perhaps need that player on the advancing Liverpool cavalry to spin around them. Yes. Raised hand again, another point to make.
It's not just, obviously he is excellent, but he's also positively influencing other Arsenal players. Guendouzi, for example, has got 6 interceptions already this season. That's again highs among all Liverpool and Arsenal players, midfielders, sorry. And then Joe Willock. Right, I think he's 19 now.
He just turned 20.
Oh, happy birthday, Joe. you know, very very talented young player. Obviously, burst through the seasons in Wenger's last season, but in the Europa League was playing very well. Didn't really get a look in last year. Mm. He's completed 5 of 6 dribbles already this season and created 2 chances. So he's playing next to Ceballos has made him better because now the midfield is set to Danny Ceballos' tempo, the same way it used to be set to Santi Cazorla's, and it just raises everyone's game because it's... The way he plays football is then the way that Arsenal's midfield plays football. It's no longer, well, what are we doing? Are we waiting for Xhaka to pass it? Are we running around like Torreira? What are we doing? Yeah. We're doing what Danny Ceballos wants to do. And as a result, I think Arsenal will win the midfield, but I don't...
Win the midfield, but they're against a front three that collectively scored in every game, I think, at Anfield against Arsenal. For Liverpool, their record against Arsenal, Sadio Mane, 6 games, 4 goals. Firmino, 8 games, 8 goals. Salah, 4 games, 3 goals. So even if you're winning the midfield, you've got to somehow resist that irresistible front three at times. David Luiz has come in, Sam. We've said Ceballos is giving them some sort of solidity in the sense that he can evade pressure. But off the ball, defensively, Is this a more solid Arsenal side? Can they resist the irresistible trio, as I said?
Well, they've had two really important tests. Obviously, the first one being tough away there at Newcastle, where they equaled their away clean sheet record for the whole of last season on day one.
Yeah.
And then the second one being home game against a stubborn team set up to make it uncomfortable. And on paper, you'd say that they're the type of games that would bring the worst out of Arsenal or bring their weaknesses to light. But they passed both of those tests. So you'd have to say the signs are encouraging, at least at the moment. I had a quick look at some numbers from the last couple of seasons. So Arsenal made 12 errors leading to goals last season, joint highest in the league with Fulham, who were obviously relegated.
Yeah, good company to be with.
The same as City, Chelsea, Wolves and Liverpool combined. And then in the 17-18 season, they made 15 errors leading to goals, which was the highest in the division. So improving on those sort of figures should be easy because they're so bad that bringing them up even just by a small margin should be straightforward.
Yeah. Well, there's already a reduction of three from that 2017 to last season.
Yeah.
So improvements well on the way.
Yeah. But yeah, so this Liverpool game is the big one, though. It's going to be the test that everyone sort of judges them by. They could keep eight clean sheets if they concede five against Liverpool. Then this is going to be the one that
people remember.
That they remember, yeah. So of course, Liverpool love to pressure defenders into making mistakes in dangerous areas and then hitting them at speed on the counter. So Arsenal, in terms of failed passes in their own half last season, they had a total of 1,011, which was the second highest in the league. Only Wolves had more. So again, on paper, it looks like it's a recipe for disaster for Arsenal. And like we said, I don't think they're going to be able to live with a front three. But Luiz coming in, definitely going to be pivotal. Obviously, he's really capable on the ball and he's probably got the technical ability to get out of those tight areas where Liverpool are going to be pressing. But if you look to the Burnley game, when he passed it right across the goal, which was crazy to see him do that. Is he going to get away with that? I would say no.
He takes risks, doesn't he? That's the thing with him.
Yeah. If you weren't going to bring it up, that's what I was going to bring up and say that you've said that David Luiz takes risks. Well, luckily it was curling away from the goal, so it never would have gone in. But
yeah.
I think that was within 5 minutes of his debut. So
I mean, they're definitely heading in the right direction. But with Luiz, I mean, it looks like it's going to be Luiz and one other in terms of the centre-backs. If he's still susceptible to a rush of blood to the head, then that's not good for the whole back four.
Yeah, and his likely partners, Socrates last season, Firmino danced a merry dance through the entire defence. It wasn't just Socrates that lunged in.
The famous picture of them all lying on the floor.
Dropping bodies. Yeah. Bobby
was that
Dazzler.
A no-look finish? I think there was a no-look finish.
There was probably.
There's always a no-look finish.
It's Firmino. Of course there's a no-look finish.
But also I'd say with Arsenal, in terms of their defence solidity, we shouldn't forget that at the moment they're playing with their two second choice fullbacks on either side. Because I'd say as soon as they're fit, then Bellerin and Tierney come straight in. So then it's always going to be important when you're creating defence that you get those partnerships within the defence. And so it might be a while before we see Arsenal's first choice actually play together.
True defensive colours. Mm. Although Ainsley Maitland-Niles himself is making a big claim to that right back spot, and someone that specifically was used, and this was Wenger's final season, was used to counter Mo Salah himself because Ainsley Maitland-Niles is an athlete.
And he scored, didn't he?
So it's actually someone that you probably would actually want Maitland-Niles playing right back to try and stop Mane, which seems impossible to do at the moment himself. And just quickly, the final point on how tough a task it is for this Arsenal defence that could be looking a bit more solid, but is still an Arsenal defence. Liverpool have scored at least three goals in each of the last four Premier League games at Anfield against Arsenal, which obviously was 5-1 last season, Firmino getting three himself, 4-0, 3-1, and then there was a 3-3. So I think this fixture is the most goal-friendly fixture in Premier League history as well. I can't remember the exact numbers. I think it's 150 plus at least. That was in the Opta preview. I know it's 150. So we can expect goals. And probably because Arsenal are playing, you definitely can expect them to concede goals. But David Luiz, Danny Ceballos, two new additions who we've covered that are going to improve Arsenal in a certain way, especially with and without the ball. Danny Ceballos' role is going to be huge. The final little storyline that we're going to investigate in this narratively charged game on Saturday evening is not a new signing, but he's like a new signing. as so often it's
the old chestnut.
I'm glad, have you been reading my notes?
I'm glad I got a little laugh out of that as well. But Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain is facing, as you pointed out to me, well, I'll give you credit, I won't nick the segue.
No, that's for fun.
As you pointed out, he's playing two former clubs in the space of a week.
Well, potentially, because we don't know. It seems 50-50 as to whether he'll start against Arsenal. Klopp's been changing that midfield around, as he did last season. Mm. And against Southampton, he was 1 minute plus stoppage time away from it being the first time he's completed 90 minutes in the Premier League in 18 months, since April 2018. And it was one of the rare sources of optimism from that Southampton game, which wasn't a comfortable win by any stretch of the imagination. You'd have to say that in the first half, Oxlade-Chamberlain's performance lacked involvement, as was the case with much of the Liverpool team. But where the team's play was generally sloppy, we spoke last week about misplaced passes, and after the game at St Mary's, Liverpool are now one of only five Premier League teams to misplace over 200 passes. Oxlade-Chamberlain, on the other hand, was in and of himself quite tidy. He recorded 90% pass accuracy, completed all four of his dribbles. We saw some nice touches on the ball, a few nice sort of long ball passes. And if he can marry that with the sort of attacking output, because I think attack-wise, he is Liverpool's most complete midfielder in terms of the impact he would have in the final third. And given Naby Keita's could be out for a while injury-wise, any improvement in this Liverpool team, and given the lack of investment in the transfer window, is riding on Oxlade-Chamberlain really sort of developing and becoming like a new signing. Mm. and I mean, going back to this claim as to the claim that he's Liverpool's most complete midfielder in an attacking sense, I base on, eye test wise, a weirdly abiding memory of his performance as a 20-year-old at the Allianz in central midfield against Bayern, Schweinsteiger, Thiago, I think, 2014, in which he just looked like a perfect Jurgen Klopp midfielder, pressed, created, dribbled. And I also base it on his statistical output per 90 minutes, the almighty caveat, per 90 minutes over the last three Premier League seasons.
Per 90 minutes last 90 minutes against Southampton.
The almighty caveat being that his absence through the knee injury means he's largely missed this playing style shift that we've covered so many times on this podcast. I don't want to go into it now. So that might have skewered his attacking output, because Liverpool were previously expected more creatively and in terms of taking risks from that midfield. But he's basically top for everything. So in terms of assists per 90 minutes, he's got the best record of anyone at the club over the last three seasons with 0.4. We're basically talking about the seven assists that he got, I think, in the 2017-18 season. Much of which came during that second half of the season after Philippe Coutinho left. And then obviously they had someone needed to sort of provide that sort of goal threat, goal provider role in central midfield. He's also top for dribbles completed per 90 minutes of any player still currently at the club. And in terms of goals scored by midfielders, I think only Lallana beats him. And then just to wrap that up, because I know that relaying these numbers can become quite dry. Mm. But in terms of chances created from open play, he's on 1.7 per 90 minutes. So if he can, like I said, combine this high level of ball retention and like sort of in terms of conservative play that he demonstrated against Southampton with something approaching this attacking output, he could be what takes Liverpool to the next level. And I think, as I said, you have to say that it's 50-50 as to whether he'll play. But based on how Milner and Henderson were just bypassed by that Chelsea midfield, another sort of youthful Chelsea midfield who like to press, I'd imagine we'll probably see two of him, Henderson and Wijnaldum, either side of Fabinho in the holding role.
He's wearing number 15 again as well, which is nice.
Yes,
just put a point that out.
nicked it off Daniel Sturridge straight away, didn't he?
Well, I mean, he probably waited like, come on, Daniel, go.
And obviously, Sturridge is now at Chubbs on Sport.
Yeah.
In case you missed it. A bit of transfer window is still open in Europe.
Should do very well,
but it's not open for Liverpool, but it doesn't matter.
I would play him, I think.
An argument which will just completely collapse after Jurgen Klopp benches
him. He benches him.
I mean, I wouldn't put Milner out there against Arsenal's midfield. But I mean, like I said, the thing is, I think ultimately what's going to come down to the fact that,
Milner's been a Klopp's go-to player in these games against the big six, we should say now. And I think we're kind of giving him a bit of a kick in on this podcast because of his two games this season, which he hasn't obviously given the best account of himself. But he's a good midfielder.
No, he's good. It's just he's not played well, and he has a penchant for getting skilled up by people and like Danny Tabas, But I mean, you're right. Klopp will play.
Danny Tabas also got skilled up himself though in that Burnley match.
Yeah,
for the Burnley goal, got absolutely turned inside
don't,
out.
Don't talk
McGill.
About negatives, Sam. Don't bring those up.
Does someone not read the agenda?
Yeah,
this is Ceballos, heir to the throne.
I can see it being Fabinho, Milner, and Henderson probably as a three. That seems like the kind of thing Klopp would do. But ultimately, I just think it comes down to how on earth Liverpool deal with Mane and Salah and Firmino.
How Arsenal will do it.
Yeah. How Liverpool do it. What if Liverpool don't take care of him?
Yeah.
Let them get injured or something.
No. Well, that'll be a quick turnaround because Thursday recording. Imagine if they were all injured. One of those freak injuries. Mane's dropped a bottle of ketchup on his toe and he's out, which needs to happen because Mane's got the most goals in 2019 without taking a penalty.
Mane's
obviously, Aubameyang's on his case. The three Golden Boot winners from last season all sharing the pitch. We've obviously mentioned Ceballos, but the spaces Liverpool are leaving behind their little fullbacks, Aubameyang will be licking his lips. And if Nicola Pepe starts as well, Arsenal, this is what I mentioned in the preview podcast, Arsenal finally have a bit of counter-attack threat now, in the sense that Pepe came on and made a fool of Ben Mee, didn't he?
Oh,
that
mate, Pepe and Ceballos. Yeah, don't get Milner away from the pitch, mate. Yeah. Pepe and Ceballos.
But maybe this will be the go-to Klopp, I'm going to play Joe Gomez, that we always talk about.
Which obviously was hugely successful against Chelsea.
Yeah. So not to
get on Joe Gomez's back.
No, I know. We've all become nasty on this podcast, apart from Danny Ceballos, as I said, evader of press and completer of dribbles in the midfield. But that rounds us off that discussion. So we've talked about Ceballos' introduction to that midfield being so important for Arsenal. Can they not concede against the most frightening front three in the Premier League? And is Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain going to become the player we know he can be? And that results in what score at Anfield at the weekend, Sam?
3-1 Liverpool.
So they continue the three-goal trend.
Yep.
Wise to continue it, Will?
Ooh, I think 3-1 is a good prediction. So I'm going to say it.
So he's going to go
3-1 Liverpool.
3-1 Liverpool.
Oh!
It's a full house.
4-1 Arsenal.
Hooray!
Over the course of this week, I've noticed a sense of confidence.
It's not
creeping in.
It's not confidence. It's blind optimism, and it's born out of the fact that it was like Arsenal didn't have this. Now they have it, and there's if it's not obvious from an Arsenal fan's perspective, it's not confidence in beating Liverpool because I'm pretty sure. The stats I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned it in the last time I talked about their record against Arsenal, but the only game that Mane, Firmino and Salah have lost in the Premier League against Arsenal combined is Mane's first ever game against Arsenal for Southampton. So that front three in themselves just love playing against Arsenal in terms of winning points. And I mentioned to you yesterday, Will, Salah even scored for Chelsea against Arsenal.
Yeah.
In the famous thousandth game. So 3-1 to Liverpool is as you said, it sounds like the safest result because Liverpool will definitely score. You can see Arsenal scoring and they've done so in apart from that 4-0 they did it 5-1. As you said Sam in your defensive point, you hope for Arsenal's sake that it isn't another 5-1 and the same trend is continued.
I can see a bit of VAR controversy as well. Maybe Arsenal score a second. And
then we'll
like,
have a whole week of conversation on that again, although being annoying, it seems to be getting stuff right with the rules that are in place.
Yes.
I think, to give my prediction, I'll say 3-2. to give Arsenal a bit more credit. I think we will see Ceballos play that Cazorla role, and Cazorla was always quite good against Liverpool himself anyway, for that reason that
he was
spoke
good
about.
Against everyone, Jack.
Yeah, Santi Cazorla was good, and now Arsenal have a midfielder that is similar to him finally. So we have 3-3-1s and a 3-2 Liverpool versus Arsenal at Anfield. So as is typical of the Squawk Talker Footballcast previews, we're going to now go back from the late kickoff on Saturday into the early kickoff, which is Chelsea versus Norwich. And we've spoken a lot about Chelsea on the recent podcast because they've been obviously playing in the Super Cup and Frank Lampard has arrived. But we're going to start with their opponents this week, and one man in particular, because Timo Pukki is having a party. And it doesn't look like it's going to stop anytime soon, Mo. So your job on the Squawk Talker podcast is to tell me, when will it stop, if at all?
Well, who knows? Look, Canaries are flying high right now. They're playing really well. They lost at Anfield, okay, but they played excellently throughout, dominated the second half, won the second half, you know, and played really well, scored a goal. Pukki scored it. It was great. Nice little finish at Anfield. Then he bags a hat-trick, second week. You're thinking, oh boy, here we go. But look at that. It's then... With lower ranked teams, they go on these runs where they like start scoring loads of goals, winning games, and you're thinking, oh, is it sustainable? Because you start looking at the numbers underlying it. Well, you have to look. You don't want anything to be jumping out ahead like weird. So like Norwich, right? They had 21 shots so far this season. That's eighth among all Premier League sides, right? And then they had 13 on target. That's second. So they're immediately hitting a lot of shots on target. Whereas, you know, the number of shots is like about eighth mid-table, whatever. And then suddenly they're hitting loads of them on target. So you're wondering about there. But everything else, like four goals is seventh. 19.5 shot conversion is sixth. 24 chances created is fifth. Four big chances created is sixth. So you can see they're all sort of about, they're playing at a sort of similar consistent level as a team, but they're hitting the target a lot, which you wonder, could that continue? And you've got Pukki himself. Nine shots, first among all players. Seven shots on target, first among all players. Four goals, first among all players. You're thinking, okay, so he's taking a lot of shots, he's scoring a lot of goals, that makes sense. But then you look at his shot conversion, and it's 44.44%. That's unsustainable over entire season.
And I'd like to point out that two games is an extremely small sample size.
All right, okay, yeah, that too.
To be saying about, obviously there's going to be weird stuff in there. Anyway,
no, there is.
It's right to look at the amount of shots though, because that is the only way you can increase.
You look at last season's, three of the last season's most accurate strikers, the highest shot conversion for last season, right? Aubameyang had 30.56%, Aguero had 24.14%, and Vardy had 26.09%, right? So 44% is way out of whack. He's not going to sustain that. So that will come down. The goals will come down, but it's how often they keep supplying him with shots and good chances, right? So against Chelsea, I think the party will keep going for this week.
They're playing today, on Thursday. Or you could be listening Saturday morning.
Well, yeah, let's assume you're listening Saturday morning.
We'll edit in a time stamp for each of those bits.
Friday. Yeah. No, look, playing against Chelsea, I do think the party will continue because, you know, Chelsea are kind of all over the shop right now. They're good. They're not great. They play nice attacking football, but they don't really have any bite to them. Norwich play nice attacking football as well, but they have bite. They have the guy on the pitch who's going to score the goals is Timo Pukki. Maybe you could argue Olivier Giroud, but who's crossing the ball to Olivier Giroud?
Christian Pulisic.
Well, no.
I imagine is who they want.
It's the guy who's injured. They're going to hand a big new contract to they really want on the pitch, crossing the ball to Giroud, Hudson-Odoi, but he's not there yet. No, I think Norwich. I think Pukki has the skills. He has the confidence right now. I think he's got what it takes to hurt the Chelsea backline. I do think Norwich will win this game. I think because primarily their play.
They're going to win at Stamford Bridge.
I think they're going to win. I think they play really nice attacking football. They've got confidence. Chelsea don't have much confidence right now. They don't look. I mean, you saw they watched the game against Leicester. They just didn't have any sort of killer instinct. Like the only goal got literally, you know, almost handed to them with a monumental defensive error.
I think it was well played by Mount.
It was good, but I don't know, I suppose.
He didn't, indeed, he didn't pass it to Mount, did he?
No, he didn't pass him. No, that's
Mount
true.
Pressed and
true.
Tackled it.
But it's just, and the fact is that that was an early-ish goal and they didn't build on it at all. They couldn't put Leicester away. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, obviously, they got pulled back as a result. I just, you worry about Chelsea because they don't have a cutting edge. I just think Pukki, because he's in, I mean, look, 44.4%, not sustainable, but right now, they're banging them in. So, you know, for as long as this lasts, I mean, and who knows how long it will last, because it could theoretically end at the bridge. But I think it's going to keep going. I think he's going to score. I think he's red hot right now. I think he's going to score maybe one, maybe two, and he'll be the difference ultimately.
So it's an all-nighter, the Pukki party is.
Oh, yeah, baby.
It's going to keep going.
All-night party people. 24-hour party.
So he, to give some more Pukki stats, because they are crazy. So Opta tweeted out that he scored with his first shot on target in each of like the last 9 seasons. He's the first player to score 4 goals in his first 2 Premier League games. Only one player already has scored 5 in their first 3 games, which was Pavel Pogrebniak. which is a blast from the past.
He was rubbish.
And then obviously that didn't continue for him. So you have to be very wary about it. Timo Pukki's obviously enjoying this bright spell, but the people that have started so quick before have actually burned out to an extent. But so if he does score, he equals that. And if he does score 2, as Mo suggested he might, he'll become the first ever to score 6 in 3 games, which is a pretty good claim to fame.
Pukki's going to break some records, boys. Break some records, break some hearts at the bridge.
But we're talking about Pukki scoring all the goals there, and rightly so. And as you said, I'm glad you picked up the shots on target stuff, because even against... who did they just beat? Was it Newcastle?
Yeah.
Yeah. He had 6 on target in that game alone, and 3 really well-taken goals. But anyway, so he's testing the goalkeeper. But the beauty of Norwich is that it's not just like give it to Pukki and let him do it. There is an actual philosophy behind it that leads to him scoring. So we thought it was good to focus on maybe not just Pukki as well, despite him scoring all the goals. Is there anyone in that Norwich side that is also deserving of a big up in terms of making Pukki this on the verge of making Premier League history? Sam, I'll go to you on that one.
Yeah, well, Pukki obviously does deserve the credit because it's his composure and finishing which is putting the ball in the back of the net, which is obviously the hardest thing to do. But there's a couple of players I wanted to highlight. First is Todd Cantwell,
yes,
who was great against Newcastle, 2 assists, not the most outrageous passes, but still impressive, particularly the second where he made the run forwards and then after receiving the ball had the awareness to turn and let it run onto Pukki. He was also unlucky not to score himself as well with his sort of little pirouette early on when I think it might still only been 1-0. But yeah, he looks really, really at home in the Premier League, but hasn't always been so clear that he was going to sort of make the step up because he actually spent some time on loan with Fortuna Sittard in the Eredivisie after Fark took over, but came back and forced his way in during the first half of last season, but then tailed off after Christmas, made just 8 appearances in the 21 games they played after the turn of the year. So there were some questions about whether he'd extend his deal longer than the 1-year option that he had. But he did. And Norwich must be really pleased that he did now, because considering how well he's made the step up. And I think he deserves big credit for taking Wes Houlihan's shirt, especially as he's a Norfolk lad. And so some people might sort of scoff at Wes Houlihan not being...
No, I wasn't. Yeah, I was laughing at Norfolk lads because you went a bit Partridge. He's a Norfolk lad.
So Houlihan, not the most glamorous of name, but he's a big...
Cult hero, yeah. Not even cult hero, just a hero at Norwich. Yeah.
So that's big shoes to be stepping into.
To give you... I don't know if you've stumbled across this stat yourself, but Cantwell, I'm glad... Again, I didn't see Sam's notes, but I was glad that he picked out Cantwell, because that's someone that when I've watched Norwich, I've been like, who's this guy? Thomas Rooney, obviously, who people should know from the Scoreboard Talker, said that it wasn't sure he was going to start, which is again the point you made. Mm-hmm. So to see him start, and then only De Bruyne has created more chances in the Premier League than Cantwell this season as well. So he went straight in my fantasy team. So if anyone wants any of those tips,
I think everyone's putting a Norwich player in.
Everyone's putting Pukki in. But get Cantwell in.
I imagine Emi Buendia is quite high.
That's where I was going to bring up next. So obviously he's not quite unsung for Norwich fans. 8 goals, 12 assists during last season's promotion season. 4 of those were for Pukki, so he's obviously really in sync. And in their sort of 4-2-3-1, he's really good at picking up those pockets. And then so is Pukki, so they're definitely really in tune. Obviously linked up for the goal at Anfield.
Mm-hmm.
And then another person I wanted to bring in, of course Pukki deserves credit for this himself, but Chris Domagala, who's Norwich's head of performance and fitness, they must have him on a serious program because he looks so fresh. There was a clip that I saw on Norwich's Twitter feed where they lost the ball and Newcastle broke, and then a Norwich defender slipped and Newcastle almost got in, and it was Pukki chasing back there, sort of 70 yards, winning the ball. And I just thought that was really impressive of him to sort of staying true to what he knows he does best.
Because he's said that he's obviously he's in the spotlight now. So there's been lots written about his backstory over the week, and much has been made about the fact he was a Celtic flop, didn't do very well there. I think it was Bronby he went to after leaving, and he said how he improved there was he worked on his defensive work because that helps him attack. So he's just a player who, besides being talented, just says the right things as well.
A manager's dream.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that's what he says is the biggest thing he improved on when he went away and
work off
basically
the ball.
And resurrected his career.
And also, as we said before the start of the season, with all those three newly promoted teams, it's so key that you have your main man scoring. If you look at Villa at the moment, we talked about Wesley, he's yet to get off the mark, and you're already thinking, oh, is he going to be able to do it? Where with Pukki, that early statement, the hat-trick and the goal at Anfield, he's going into every game now. So they're playing Chelsea this weekend. Instead of going, oh, I can't really see him scoring, I'd fancy him to score now. And that's massive. He can walk into every game with his chest out. He knows that he's already competing with the best defenders.
Yeah, especially tight, for a team like Norwich as well, because when you play that kind of open attacking football, if you aren't scoring goals, teams will just destroy you on the break. Mm. If your attack doesn't have any bite and you're still committing men forward, teams will know, oh, okay, so they're not going to score. We can push on and the break against them, and we can absolutely hammer them. So You know, it's almost as important to the defense as it is to the attack that Pukki keeps scoring goals. Because if it dries up, then teams will just send their fullbacks forward, they'll send everyone forward, and they'll destroy Norwich's defense because that's not the best defense. But as long as Pukki keeps scoring, which I mean, I agree, I think he's going to keep doing it this week. I think they'll do the business.
He's got a long way to go to beat Kevin Phillips.
Yeah,
record of. Well, I think goals in his first season, because I know Salah got obviously 32 in his first, but that was his first for Liverpool. Whereas Phillips, I think, has got the record for most goals in the first Premier League season with 30, and then got himself a golden European goal.
Phillips and Quinn, that was
I think he's the only Englishman to ever win the golden.
Yeah, that season itself is such an under the radar season when you look back at the names he was actually beating. But maybe.
I was going to say Pukki as well. He's still some way to go to beat Mikel Forsell's record for Premier League goals on 34. If he's going to become the all-time finisher.
Yeah. What do you mean? He'll do that this season, mate. 34 goals, no problem.
He's going to beat Salah. We said, is the Pukki party going to stop? No. And he's going to score 40 in the Premier League.
The Pukki party's never going to stop, baby.
No. Quick word then. And I think the point you just made there, Mo, about a team that piles forward will eventually concede if they don't score.
Yeah.
Sounds like Frank Lampard's Chelsea.
Yeah.
Really?
Because I put down on the agenda, and after listening to Mo go in on Chelsea a little bit, I think this might have been a miscalculation on my part, but I said that the winner of this game takes home the crown of Premier League's most likeable team. Which would probably sound crazy to anyone who supports another big team in the Premier League to see Chelsea as being a likeable team. But what I am trying to highlight here is how one of the Premier League's least likable clubs is becoming one of its most likable clubs under Frank Lampard.
Because they're not winning.
Because that will come back to bite them in a bit when I get to the end of this argument.
Here we go.
But
strapping.
Chelsea's 3 defeats aren't quite being portrayed as it's quite the crisis you'd imagine they would be under Maurizio Sarri.
They didn't lose to Leicester.
Three game winless run.
But this is what I mean. The fact you almost said it was a defeat is again it seems worse than it is.
Well, no, because I'm saying it seems better than it is. They're yet to win and they're 15th in the league. Yeah. But it's because, I think it's for two reasons, basically. Lampard, for all that some say, he's getting favourable press coverage because of his relationship with the media, has delivered on promises, the promises that accompanied his appointment. He's played youth and an attractive playing style that's less, not prosaic, but I don't know what the term would be, but for Sarri's kind of quite rigid, routine.
You metronomic.
Know, yeah, exactly. And also Chelsea have gotten the most airtime. Like by the end of game week four, they along with Man City will be the only two teams who have had all their Premier League games televised, and they've also had the UEFA Super Cup broadcast, of course. And that might seem a strange thing to pick out, but what it means is that more people are watching the actual games rather than the highlights, and those who watch them have been entertained by like the end-to-end stuff. And actually, Chelsea have created the second most chances in the Premier League, which feels kind of right to, based on anyone who's seen the sort of the fast starts they've made, then undermined by an inability to manage games that comes from the naivety of the young players, young, quite likeable players. Had those games not been televised, that would have come with a lower level of media coverage because of like simultaneous 3 p.m. Games competing for attention, and many will be only going off like top line stats, such as they've only scored one league goal, conceded five, and they're 15th in the league. There is, of course, though, the other end of this is that there's like a deadline for that Chelsea to start getting results, because and the price they'll pay for not meeting that deadline is they'll continue this evolution into like what Jamie Carragher said of becoming the new Arsenal. Perhaps not for the reasons Jamie Carragher meant it, but I always found it quite strange that neutrals who didn't used to play for Arsenal kind of just always seem to go in hard on them in shows. And I think it's because they kind of entertain and they suck you into like quite enjoying watching them and developing maybe a bit of a soft spot for them. And then that completely gets undermined by mistakes, lapses in concentration, and the affection morphs into frustration, and that leads to sort of like over the top criticism and disdain. and you can totally see this happening to Chelsea if they continue to capture the hearts of the neutrals. That's a joke. I'm not. Yeah.
Don't
just to, just to signpost that. Yeah. I think if you've not seen the sort of the expression on my face when I said that, then that might not come across.
So you're saying Chelsea are going to break our achy, breaky hearts?
I am, because I'm starting to like them much more. And
I would agree that I'm starting to as well. I think it's probably mainly through the Lampard.
And it's because they've entertained us and don't look like so much of a threat.
Yeah, just that deep down, we all quite like the fact that Mason Mount's playing.
Yeah.
And they're playing fun football. But the best thing is that the relentless trophy-winning machine, cutthroat Chelsea monolith is no longer dominating.
Do you remember how nice...
Then that'll get old and they'll become...
I was going to say, do you remember how nice Sir Alex Ferguson got about Arsenal for a while there, towards the end? He was like, oh, I love Arsenal. Arsenal is great, isn't he? And it's like, you just think, oh, okay.
The most cutting things was when he spoke about Liverpool being sort of like, oh, they're a great club with great history. And then he just felt like he could totally say that. Cause
they're a great club with great history. Yeah. Who were eighth?
Yeah.
I was going to say that you said that Chelsea losing sort of feeds into people liking them more, but then if you look at Man United, they've stopped winning and people still
but I think they had a lot more in the bank in terms of
it's like Man United, just like you've been waiting for 20 years to fall and they finally did.
One thing I remember a couple of seasons ago, looking at the Man United team and just thinking, you had people like Wan-Mata there, and it's like, I don't really hate any of these Man United players. I think Ander Herrera was the only one that would be a bit annoying and sort of like, you know, come out with the whole bravado that a lot of Manchester United players.
And he literally said he liked being hated, didn't he?
Yeah.
Ander Herrera, PSG.
But this is the thing with Chelsea. I think you look at, there's not really any players there that you wouldn't like. Like, they're all really quite nice players. I mean, and who couldn't want to see the likes of Fikayo Tomori, Hudson-Odoi when he comes back, Ruben Loftus-Cheek when he comes back, Mason Mount playing well. I mean, it's really watching Mason Mount play in the Premier League with confidence for Derby, managed by Frank Lampard. It's great, isn't it? It's really good. You know, even Barkley, you're seeing him finally come good. And just wait till Reece James gets back, you know. Yeah. So, I mean, that it's going to be even. I mean, and 100%, by the way, Azpilicueta is getting benched for Reece James. You can see it already. Azpilicueta looks exhausted.
Well, that was the thing you said, Will, there about the naivety of the young side making the mistakes. Azpilicueta. And I don't actually think it's his fault.
No, it's not.
He's being asked to rampage up that right wing at every opportunity. And I think Carragher, again, did an analysis on this as well, on M&F. And they were like, they just need to be more organised in an attack. Because when they go forward, it's almost like someone says, Aspie, go, join them as well. So even if it's on the left-hand side of the pitch, you see Azpilicueta steam up to the edge of the box. And then if someone gives it away, then there's just that gaping counter-attacking hole.
And that
would
be created by the naivety of a young manager.
Yes.
And he's probably played like about, 10,000 minutes in the last three seasons, four seasons? He's got to have so many minutes in his legs. So, you know, you need to be a bit kinder with him, I think, and give him a bit less, bit less to do. Or you play Reece James. So, you know, Chelsea, I did say they would struggle this season, and I do think they will. But I think it's not... I mean, I really hope. I mean, I wrote an article about how this is going to change their club mentality, which is win stuff or get sacked, or win stuff or get sacked, or both. So hopefully now Lampard does change the way Chelsea think, because you can see them building a really, really nice, attractive, positive team full of young players from their academy, not even just like young players from their academy that have been there since they were like 8 years old. Fikayo Tomori is another one of those guys. They could finally make use of that amazing youth team that they have that wins everything, and actually bring these kids into the first team and change their identity completely and become a likable team. Like, everyone's going to like, and even if they start winning things again, if they do it with homegrown players, that's the story that Abramovich has wanted since the start. That was like, he wanted to be Barcelona when he first took over, and then ended up becoming Real Madrid, which is, you know, just as good for him. But now he can actually morph into the club, you know, this amazing English club, the bastion of young English talent, bringing them through. I mean, you know, what and with Lampard at the helm, what could Chelsea want more? But they have to stick with Lampard. They have to show faith in him, because it's not going to start, not going to happen now.
And as Will pointed out, the revolution is being televised.
God, you've just been like sat on that for about five minutes.
I have. And this next match, though, all of that positivity winds back down to predictions on this match, the Poogie Party versus the Lampard's revolution. All of that positivity, but it sounds like everyone thinks Norwich is still going to win.
Yeah, Norwich.
I don't think Chelsea are going to win.
And what score do you feel for this one?
I think Chelsea, because the thing that. The flip side of Norwich having so many shots on target is that they're also conceding so many shots on target. I think they're like in the top five for the number of shots on target that Tim Krul has stopped.
Or not stopped against Liverpool.
Yeah, true. That is the other caveat. Nine of them or something came against Liverpool. But I think Chelsea will create several big chances, and I think it's just a case of whether they can finally start putting them away with a bit more
conviction.
Yeah. And I think this will be the game which they have enough chances so that they can maybe score two of them. Finally score more than a goal. And I think 2-1 is our go-to. But you haven't quite made up your mind. Well, 2-1.
This is it. If you feel like both are going to score but no one's going to dominate, then 2-1 is perfectly fine to say, Will. Sam, any different?
I think 1-1.
I think if Lampard, by the way, does fail to win... and I say I think I'd worked out yesterday. He's the first manager in the Abramovich era that will have failed to win any of his first three Premier League games.
Yeah, those stats like that tend to rack up as well because you kind of hit a period in which you're just breaking it every week, and there's a slightly different variation of an unwanted accolade.
And Benitez actually did it, but was caretaker technically. Yeah. So you can include him. But what I found even more impressive was the last five managers had. I think there was one draw between them. So everyone actually had started. This is the first time Chelsea haven't started well with a new manager. And as we said, it's because it's completely different circumstances now. But there's so many things to point to this clear shift in Chelsea, like on-pitch results, actual philosophy and playing style. So Lampard could join an unwanted club with Benitez. Or make some sort of history himself, depending which way you want to spin it. Mo, you said a Norwich win, and you said 2-1.
2-1. Pukki's going to score on both, man. But I do think Chelsea will actually manage to bag a goal from somewhere.
Yeah.
Mason Mount, maybe. Or maybe Giroud. If they just give him good service, he can score.
Ultimate link man. I'm going to say 2-2.
Oh, I love a 2-2.
What a surprise. Just because of what we spoke about. It's super open. They both look fun. And Cantwell's going to be tearing it up, is my prediction.
He's your new favourite, isn't
he? Yeah, I can't wait to watch him in that game specifically.
Don't you mean Canwell?
Yes, exactly. What? No one's said that one yet, I don't think. So yeah, that is what we believe will happen at Stamford Bridge this Saturday. We'll take another little break and then we're going to rattle through the rest of the Premier League fixtures before moving over to Europe. Before we move on to the Premier League predictions, as I said, I should probably flag that you should ignore every mention of Stamford Bridge in the previous section, because it was written down, and I won't say who wrote it down, it was written down with Chelsea first, so I just assumed Stamford Bridge without double-checking, but Norwich are at home.
Is the reason you won't say who wrote it down because it was you, Jake?
It wasn't me. I promise.
I am Spartacus.
So I'm hoping, now I'm going to still read from the agenda, and I'm hoping these are all the right way around, but if they're not, I apologise. So yeah, Norwich are at home, which means they're definitely going to win now. It's not going to be 2-2. Norwich 8, Chelsea 1. But moving on to actual games and actual predictions, Friday night football is back. Aston Villa versus Everton. Jack Grealish still hasn't won a Premier League game. Is this going to be it, Sam?
No, I think it's another L incoming for Jackie Boy, I think.
Really? Yeah. An actual defeat as well, because yeah, they're at home.
Yeah. So Everton haven't conceded a goal at home since February 6th. Obviously they're away, but yep. 10 clean sheets in 13. and all four Everton defenders have started to open in two rounds of the season. So I fancy if they can keep that continuity, then they'll...
And as you mentioned in the Norwich section, Aston Villa sort of looking at their striker to finally score.
Exactly.
And Mina's playing well. I'll let you mention that.
Yeah, no, he is, but it's... he's just the best friend in the world, Jake. Oh, yeah. It's what can you say? And Lucas Digne's playing well, Michael Keane. They look really good, Everton, at the back. I don't think they're going to give Villa too much of a look-in. Villa have shown that they need a lot of look-ins to get anything. I think 1-0 Everton. I think they'll just...
You know. Everton's becoming that sort of just grinding away results team, yeah. Which is...
With Charleston wearing number 7, Calvert-Lewin in number 9.
I know.
I like that. That's nice.
That went under the radar.
I think 1-0 Everton as well.
There you go. Yeah. Round that one off. Brighton versus Southampton I've got down next.
Yeah, that's
Brighton
have been...
Pardon?
I can confirm.
Oh, correct. Brighton obviously have been quite interesting under Graham Potter. Southampton lost both their games, despite them... There being some hope of them actually performing again. But
I went big on Southampton in the predictions podcast. I think I tipped them to be the surprise package.
Oh, at least you're honest.
And Adams, I should say.
Yeah.
Yet to get off the mark as well. Yeah. So another tip that's blowing up in spectacular
It's
fashion.
Only been two games, to be fair. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're being harsh on yourself.
Yeah, we're being...
Cheers.
We're being completely reactive.
I think 1-1.
And Che Adams. Just finally score. Yep. Should be.
I know this sounds like I'm just waiting for someone else to make predictions and copy them, but I actually think 1-1 as well.
I think it'll be a nil. I think it will be a draw. I think Saints, they just need to stop the bleeding. I think they have trouble scoring goals, as we saw at Anfield. I mean, they got gifted one, and then, I mean, the chance that Ings missed that should have basically made it a draw. I mean, I think they're going to have still going to have trouble scoring goals. I think Brighton, they're good. They're not great. I think nil. I think they'll both try to win. Neither will have the ability, and then they'll just settle for a draw for like 70 minutes.
Draws all around for that one. Man United, Crystal Palace. Wan-Bissaka finally faces Zaha in an actual match.
Mate, Wan-Bissaka's at the wheel. Don't you worry about that. Man United are going to win this 2-0.
The man that made Wan-Bissaka the tackle king that he is, Wilfried Zaha, has now got a try. I'm actually excited to watch it. Because obviously Zaha plays on the sort of left-hand side.
Yeah.
Well, it's at 3 p.m. so you won't be able to.
I won't be able to watch it.
Legally, anyway.
And that is correct. We will not be able to watch it until the highlights are on. But genuinely, though, Wan-Bissaka has already made the most tackles in the league. He made 9 in that 1-1 draw against Wolves, which is the most in a single game this season.
He was ridiculous. The way he snuffed out Diogo Jota was just unreal. He's so... Like everyone's going to point to Maguire, and obviously Maguire's a great defender, great leader. But I think the way that United get blitzed down the flanks, I think Wan-Bissaka is probably the most important signing by far. He shuts down that entire side, and that's huge for United.
And here's another thing I've been sitting on. Obviously, Spider-Man looks like it might be cancelled. Oh. But maybe it's because they had Spider-Wan planned all along.
Hey.
The actual groans.
There you go, Marvel.
I can't not say this, can I?
Well, no, I mean, look, Marvel have lost out on Spider-Man. Yeah. They just need to get Spider-Man
in.
bring it back to Palace. They were...
Yes, quick.
awful last week. Obviously, had a really slow start last season. 2 wins in the opening 13 games. And they really can't afford to have such a slow start again.
That is a habit they've been for like 5 seasons. Or something like that. They always start... campaign slowly.
And then after this, they've got Villa, Spurs, Wolves and Norwich. So two potential relegation candidates there, as well as two other high flyers. So if they don't get anything this weekend...
And Chelsea being the relegation candidate. And Norwich the high flyer.
Then they're going to be looking like they've left themselves with too much to do after sort of 10 games again.
Guess who said they'd be going down?
Me. Was it, I guess?
Me. Yeah, me.
I mean, you literally pointed to yourself after you said.
No, but I'm glad to see that they're backing up. So, not all of our predictions.
I'm glad to see that they're backing up your predictions.
Yeah. No, they are. I thought they were going to be bad. And Sam just said they were terrible, weren't they?
They were very bad.
But they finished last season well, so maybe they'll just repeat that formula.
I do think they'll defend fairly well. They'll manage to stifle United a little bit, because United are still, they didn't sign number 10. They aren't the best at breaking down teams, but I think United will have too much quality. And
one thing to note here, last season they were better away. I think they had a terrible home record.
They just lost to Sheffield United away.
Well, last season, I said. and then the second part of my point, which would address your gripe with my sentence, is that they played much better against the bigger teams.
Yeah.
And... United a bigger team.
But was Wan-Bissaka a reason for that?
That's a good point.
They need Zaha back firing all cylinders, don't they?
Yeah.
If they're going to stay up, they need...
And that's what I mean. He's now facing his greatest challenge in his almost apprentice. Attacking his dribbling partner.
Obi-Wan versus Anakin.
All the films coming out. All the really obvious film references you could make.
Yeah. I think 2-0 Man United as well.
Yeah. I think 3-1 United.
3-1? No, yeah. I can't see Palace scoring.
Yeah, that's what I think. Yeah.
I think it could just be a little 1-0. Nothing too exciting. Next two teams, Watford, West Ham. I think both of...
Watford look really bad. Yeah. Like Javi Gracia is a great coach. I do think they'll get it together at some point, but they just look off right now.
I did see suggestions they deserved something from the Everton defeat last week.
Dini had that great chance that Pickford saved with his face.
I think Doulopcore had a good chance.
I just think... West Ham as well, I think they've it depends obviously if Haller's back or anything. I mean, if he's not, but I think West Ham have too much attacking talent. I think this could easily be 0-0, but I do think West Ham might pip it. Like, I think 2-0, I think, but they'll just do enough to get to get through.
Lanzini looks very good, finally back from injury.
Well, yeah, so Anderson missed the game as well at Brighton, and Fornals played, but he really struggled, and I'd be pretty worried about that if I was a West Ham fan, because is it a case of he's going to struggle during these away days, or can he learn from it up to par?
No Danny Ceballos, was he?
No.
On his debut. But again, as I said, to flag all of these quite sweeping statements that I've made, I think without actually realising, we are obviously 2 games in, but there are certain patterns emerging that have caught notice.
I think Watford 2-1.
Watford get, because Sarr might play, the record signing is being touted for a debut, which could be a game changer.
Yeah. I think 1-1.
1-1. Sheffield United versus Leicester City is the next 3 PM game. Just quick thoughts on that. Sheffield United again, finally getting a win. At home, obviously, doing that well, which is the crux of their form. I think Chris Wilder's record at home as Sheffield United manager is incredible. And Leicester, as we said, weren't very good against Chelsea in the first half, but then showed why they were mentioned in our sort of battle for the breaking the top six.
I think Leicester will take this one. I think Sheffield United have started very well, but it seems like the dream is going to end at some point. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're playing really well. You're like, oh, they're great. But I think Leicester have got too much quality in midfield. I think Maddison is warming up quite nicely. I think he's got the most shots and the most chances created, I think, for any Leicester player. I think he's
skying him over the bar though at the moment.
Yes, you know, he needs to get his eye in. Vardy's there. Vardy might really, I mean, Ramble Lane seems like the kind of place Vardy would relish playing, you know, that kind of loud away ground. He'd love to silence the crowd.
Them, yeah.
Yeah, so I think Leicester win 2-1. I think they've got just enough to take care of this.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I'll go along with that.
I think Leicester 3-1. And on Maddison, I just wanted to mention that I thought during his interview after the Chelsea game, when Ndidi was sort of visibly upset at his mistake, I think he deserves big credit for sort of putting his arm around him and lending him his support, because he could have easily sort of brushed it off. He was there to collect the Man of the Match award. But he took time out to sort of make the point that Ndidi was still really important to the side. And then he still found time to take the mick out of Jeremy Clarkson on Twitter.
Yeah. So, that was a very good burn, by the way.
Very good, wasn't it? Nice hashtag.
Can't remember quite.
Yeah. But I want to point out in the interview as well, I think it was Jeff Shreves doing it. He obviously was asking Ndidi about the mistake and then felt so guilty that he'd asked him about his mistake, said, well, the Man of the Match award was close between you two. It could have been either one. And if we're being honest, it couldn't have been Ndidi because he conceded another goal. But it was like that moment where he was like, oh, now I've got to say your mistake. And I now think, please give the Man of the Match award.
Because I think he was worried that Ndidi was going to misunderstand him and think that he had the Man of the Match award, which would have been even more awkward.
But yeah, he was trying to say like
the old Alex song with the trophy.
Oh, no, nothing can beat that. Last few games to rattle through: Bournemouth versus Man City. Raheem Sterling loves playing Bournemouth, and Raheem Sterling loves football full stop at the moment. I think that's going to be quite a high scoring one.
5-0 Man City. They're going to kill them. They're the best team. They're the best team in the league by a million billion miles. If last weekend didn't make it even more evident, despite the result. Bournemouth are, I mean, like you said, they love playing Bournemouth. Bournemouth are the perfect side for City. They'd attack them and then just get destroyed. Sterling loves it. He'll probably bag another hat trick. Who the hell knows?
I'll row it back a little bit and just say 3-0.
I think it's going to be 2-1 to Man City.
What is that?
Who are you going with for your Bournemouth goal scorer?
Callum Wilson.
Yeah. Okay. That's so
but the narrative is going to be my boy Aaron Ramsdale in goal. He was man of the match for Bournemouth last week at Villa Park, and I think this is going to be his game where people sort of notice him, because by the end of the season he's going to be knocking on the door of the England squad.
England's future number one is either going to have a great game or concede 5.
Either way, he's going to come out with credit.
The thing is, he could play brilliantly and still concede 5. Yeah. So it's, you know.
So there we go. Maybe it'll be both. And then the final two games, Spurs versus Newcastle. Newcastle, again, look a bit...
The last two home games Spurs have played against Newcastle since they came back up have both been 1-1-0, and Son has either scored or assisted the goal, and Son is back from suspension, so they're going to win 1-0, and Son is going to score or assist the goal.
Well, no one else needs to say anything to that.
No.
Sound logic. Wolves versus Burnley.
2-2. Why not? It's hard to call this, because honestly, this is, again, I mentioned, like, this is just going to be like the Simpsons soccer thing where it's like, holds it. Neither of these teams wants the ball, even more so than Man United versus Wolves. This is just going to be...
Wolves will be fresh from a Europa League game as well, which could affect the performance. Although, Burnley will be like, we know all about that.
I will say, Dwight McNeil could be decisive in this instance, because while Burnley will not want the ball in general, he's very good at dribbling with the ball when you give it to him. So it could be a sort of give it Dwight and then let's see what he can create. And then, you know, with Barnes, you only have to give him half a chance, really.
Get the crosses in.
Whereas Wolves need a bit more of an intricate thing. But that said, I just think 2-2. I think it's going to be a draw. I think they'll cancel each other out or they'll score goals. Yeah. Jan Moutinho and Jan Gudmundsson both have created 4 chances from set pieces. It's the highest in the league. So it could be a set piece showdown, to be honest.
Set piece showdown.
People need to start standing up to Ashley Barnes, because he's absolutely munching everyone.
Well, did you see that? I was well proud of the Photoshop on last week's graphic of the sharp pun. Well, sharp shooter.
That makes one of you.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. But that leaves all the Premier League predictions rattled through. Again, we can't always talk about every team, but we tried to do a bit of analysis there. The final part of the podcast, which will have to be maybe a bit more brief than we first expected, given how much detail we've given you on the other games. We thought we'd take a swing over to Europe and discuss a little bit about Inter Milan. Yeah. for the final part of the podcast, as I said, moving away from Premier League football and looking at Serie A, and specifically this time around Inter Milan, who have not only signed Romelu Lukaku for a club record fee, but now they're looking to dip back into the Man United market once again and pick up Alexis Sanchez to complete the complete revamp of their attack. Icardi has not left yet, but his number has been just taken.
Yeah,
and there seems to be interested parties at least. But even if they do keep him and he doesn't start, you've got a proven goal scorer on the bench.
Yeah, I think Alexis, this is the perfect sort of scenario for him, really, in a way, because he's still a great footballer, right? I mean, but he hasn't played great. He hasn't played well. The only time since, to the end of 2016-17, the only time he's played well since then has been in pre-season for last season, when he played in a two-man attack with Juan Mata in a 3-5-2, United played 3-5-2. Alexis had a summer off. He looked amazing. You're thinking, oh my God, here we go. And then he was rubbish when the football started. Because, I mean, who the hell knows? Mainly because Man United stopped playing 3-5-2, I think. So you play him in this 3-5-2 with Conte. Conte's preferred formation. Obviously, at Juventus, he used 3-4... Chelsea used 3-4-2-1 because he had to accommodate Eden Hazard. But 3-5-2 is the formation. So you play 3-5-2 now. You got Lukaku as your line in number 9. That's obvious, right? He wanted him at Chelsea. Lukaku wanted to go to Chelsea, apparently, until Pogba and Mourinho changed his mind, apparently. So whatever that is. So now he's playing for Conte. Now he's going to be the line in number 9. You can see him with Candreva, Dalbe, the guys supplying him with crosses. He's going to score loads of goals, I think. So you need someone to play off him. Now, Lautaro Martinez is very talented, but Lukaku's not a hold-up number 9. He's not like a Drogba kind of player. So Lautaro does a lot of the same sort of things that Lukaku does, if that makes sense. Like, he's much smaller and everything, but he runs more with the ball than Lukaku does, but he runs in behind, tries to score goals. So maybe you don't want to pair them all the time. You want someone who can be on the ball a lot more, you know, who has a lot more range and a lot more ideas to his game. And that's Alexis Sanchez. He fits perfectly because you look at 3-5-2, when Conte played it for Juventus, he had Llorente as the big number 9, or Morata, and then he often played Carlos Tevez, who was a misfit striker from South America who failed in the Premier League after initial success in the Premier League. And
That was quick.
After great success in the Premier League, became a misfit, looked unhappy, for some reason just wasn't playing well, went to Inter because he wanted so much tactical freedom and got it at Juventus. Now, Alexis Sanchez, same sort of thing. Amazing, world-class player. One of the three best players in the league for I don't know how many years that he was at Premier League. Suddenly he looks rubbish. Suddenly he looks disinterested. Something's wrong with him. No one knows what it is. You send him to Serie A under Antonio Conte, one of the best coaches in the world, in a tactical system that's just going to let him do whatever the hell he wants, because 3-5-2 does that. They've got the framework of the team. Lukaku is a reference up front. Alexis, just do what you want. Get involved in the play. And I think actually it makes so much sense, because he hasn't stopped being talented. It's just
he's just stopped being fit, though.
Well, that's an issue. Well, you can't be unfit against Conte. He won't even play you if you're not fit.
Well, that's what I mean. That's why
it's the perfect scenario for him. I think he'll do very. I think if they get him, I think it's win-win for Man United. It's a huge win for Man United getting those wages off the wage bill. And I think it's a big win for Inter. I think this could be Juve are an FFP black hole. They're struggling to. I mean, they don't look very impressive. Sarri's going to take away. I mean, they'll revolt against Sarri at some point, 100%. It could be Inter could do it. They could break the monopoly.
Imagine if Man United sell Lukaku and Sanchez, and they both break the 9-year streak of Juventus title wins.
We should mention Napoli there as well as another contender to do it.
Yeah, they fly so low under the radar because obviously they've not got the same spending power, and then people have just since Sarri left sort of like, oh, Ancelotti's there, by the way. Mm. He's won a lot of titles.
I think the strength, though, that Antonio Conte will inherit, and he is someone who came to the Premier League and in his first season won the Premier League after a quite a sort of shaky start.
Yeah.
There was a defeat to Arsenal that created uncertainty around him. But the strength he inherits from this Inter side is they were second best defence in Serie A last season, second only to Juventus in terms of the fewest number of goals conceded across the division. Handanovic, super solid goalkeeper. I think he was named best goalkeeper at Serie A, but people queried that decision.
They were new awards based on some sort of FedEx sponsored performance score. So I think people were like, these don't make much sense.
And then if you look at a sort of, because Conte, from what I read, is like insisting that the youth teams play with that back three system. So it's just the philosophy of the club is back three. And then you look at the three centre backs he can assemble: De Vrij, Skriniar, And when Godin returns from injury, he comes into the middle, you expect. It's a solid sort of back four in terms of
With the goalkeeper.
And then Mo's mentioned Kandreva. I think he's their sort of right wing back option who's been playing there in pre-season. And as Mo's mentioned, loves a cross.
Loves a cross. In fact, Inter fans, and I think Serie A fans in general, think he loves a cross too much.
Yeah.
He's always the source of quite a lot of criticism in the sense that he fires so many balls into the box.
It's going to work. It finally
might work, but that's one to look out for, is how quickly, again, if you're talking about revolt on Sarri. Because obviously Conte as well picked out Perisic straight away and was like, oh, he can't play left wing back and he can't play out front. So go away. Mm. He's ruthless, Conte, when he comes in.
Like, it seems quite an uncertain position at the moment for them. But the midfield looks pretty cool. Brozovic could be like the Cesc Fabregas in terms of like a creative midfield who's slowly throughout his career drifted back into a deeper role.
If you're going back to the Juventus 3-5-2.
Nicolò Barella, obviously he's their high profile midfield signing this summer. And then Sensi is another guy they signed. I think they beat Milan to his signature. Is supposedly impressed in pre-season. So it's quite a cool little midfield trio there.
Yeah, and you can see the way that they are trying to, Conte is trying to replicate that into setup, in the sense that, as you said, Brozovic to sit there and keep possession and then just buying absolute dynamite midfielders to shuttle alongside him and actually link the play without actually having a playmaker. And then, as you mentioned, Mo, then they've got sort of that destructive chaos forward that is capable of doing quite a lot of things. So are they a contender to Maurizio Sarri's Juventus squad, which is, he's tried to get rid of quite a lot of players, I think, because they've brought in so many free transfers they had to reduce the squad list.
He was basically, from the comments I read, he was basically having a go at the media for like failing to convey the situation that they're working under, is that they've got a bloated squad with really good players because they keep signing midfielders on free transfers.
They can't
really
resist.
And that creates like issues where you're going to have to bench someone who's actually very good.
Yeah. But there you go, Maurizio. We're covering it from your point of view. Your squad is too large.
Just sucking up to Maurizio.
Your squad is too large. And that's why Dybala was linked away, because he was a saleable asset. People were going to be interested in someone that is obscenely talented. His little chip in pre-season, I think, is wet everyone's appetite again a season.
Yeah, and there's a turn before it.
Yeah. So clearly talented. Is it a good Juventus squad? Maybe good enough to win Serie A, Sam.
Yeah, well, that's it. They're not going to have too many chinks in their armour. I'd say that they're going to win Serie A, but we all know that the Champions League is the one they want. And if I was going to pick out weaknesses, then they're not striking weaknesses, but I'd say in the goalkeeping department, Chesney is not top bracket, and then Buffon, as sort of painful it is to see him in decline, he's definitely past his best.
60 now, isn't he?
And then I'd probably say as well that up top they could have a bit of a problem. Obviously you've got Ronny, but I don't think anyone is expecting to fall off this season, but his 28 goals in 43 matches last season are really good numbers, but they're going to need to be supplemented by others. So Dybala and Mandzukic are the only other two players who hit double figures, and neither of them did it in Serie A alone. So they can't solely rely on Ronaldo. Picking up on what Will said about Sarri, I think that his approach could potentially turn into a weakness, in that because if he's got so many options, there's so many little tweaks and alterations that could be available to him. It's like a Tinker Man's dream, the squad, but that's exactly the opposite of what he is. So once he settles on a formula, is his starting 11 just going to be a closed shop like it was at Chelsea? Or was his starting 11 at Chelsea a closed shop because he didn't feel he had the strength and depth? Because as Mo touched on as well, the criticisms of, oh, what did he ever win in the game? He's just a banker. Those questions are still relevant. When every new job he takes and a new set of players who have to learn his ideas or buy into his ideas, there's always going to be a risk that they won't. Mm. And Juve have some massive egos in their squad. Yeah. So midway through the season, he could come a cropper a bit if his man management skills, which by all accounts seem to be what is always called into question, are gets him on the wrong side of a few of the big names.
And that's the thing, is if he does just have, is Ramsey Rabiot going to be the only sub that we ever see, sort of thing as well? Because he's got to get them in somehow.
He was saying that like they might even have to, because they're going to have to leave some players that are really good outside out of their Champions League squad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Basically, so, since Beppe Marotta left, their squad management has gone to Beppe Marotta, who is now at Inter, by the way. Is their squad management is shambolic. Like Pavel Nedved and all the guys. I mean, I love Pavel Nedved, but they've really sort of let it go. And like the fact that they're looking to sell Dybala, it's ludicrous. Really, you think how good he actually is, and it's like, what are you doing? Are you crazy? Are you feeling okay? It's like, but that's the kind of panic they're in. I think that's what gives Inter a huge chance, because Juve are kind of at a crossroads. Like Sam says, Chesney in goal. I mean, okay. And, you know, Chiellini's getting old. I know they've signed De Ligt, which is really big, and he'll be there for, I don't know, when does his clause come into active? 3 years, I think. His 150 million release clause. So he'll be there until that expires. And Mino Raiola wants another payday. But he's phenomenal. He's an amazing defender. He's a great leader. We saw with Ajax. He'll be good. But I just think, you know, Pjanic is going to be at the base of midfield, right? You'd figure.
Yeah.
That's guaranteed. And then it's like, but then who moves up the rest of the things? And does he play Ramsey and Rabiot? They're kind of similar. And then do Ramsey and Rabiot become the new Kovacic and Barkley? That's what you said. So it's like, what's he going to do? There's talent there. How's he going to fit Cristiano in? Is Cristiano going to be the Insigne, or is he going to be the Mertens? Surely you'd think the Mertens, but...
I think he's going to be left Insigne... probably had about 200 shots in his final season under Sarri, so that suits Ronaldo down to a T, I think.
Yeah, and you know, it's just a matter of, because the thing is, he cannibalised all their goals for himself last season, because that's the way he does. No, but then you need to have players who can not necessarily get like high volume of shots and still score goals. Like Real Madrid had Benzema, who is very good at delivering and scoring certain types of goals, and what Juventus need to find is a player who can help Ronaldo get his shots and help Ronaldo get his goals, but also then get theirs. And those kind of players aren't easy to find. It's very rare. That's why Madrid was so valued Benzema so highly, because he could still score you 20, 15, 15 odd goals and also help Cristiano get loads. And so, you know, and who are they going to be on the other wing? Is it Douglas Costa? Is he going to be the guy? Is it going to be Cuadrado? I mean, but, you know, Bernadeschi, there's a lot of talent in Juve. It's just a matter of figuring out how it's all going to work together.
They could have two 11s. I think it would actually be good. It would be quite refreshing from Sarri to say, I'm not going to change the actual 11s until I do a new competition and just puts out a new champion and just constructs a Champions League team
His
4-3-3 and only plays that in Champions League.
Which one's Ronaldo in there?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
Champions League.
Yeah. Ronaldo, because his quotes that came out was like, I could retire by next year.
Well, he was just, I think he's just kind of trying to create headlines. It was like, I could retire next year. I could play until I'm 40 or 41. Yeah. So what have we learned from that? Yeah.
I think what was notable is his league total last year was 21 goals, right? That's not too far off what he's managed in the last few league campaigns with Real Madrid. What was different, what fell off, was his Champions League, right, where he's been scoring 10 plus for like 3 years in a row.
Remember that? He scored six.
He got sent off though, didn't he?
But my point is,
that was a kind of dodgy sending off.
Definitely a strange sending off. My point is, it's, if you're Juventus, right, like they played him, do you rest him more for the Champions League now? Do you actually do that?
Yeah.
I know he probably wants to play every game because he is who he is. But if you want to get the best out of him where you want him, where you need him the most, Juventus doing in the Champions League, surely you rest him.
Yeah, I think towards the end of last season that almost happened, because he wasn't playing any of the Serie A games really, and that's why he almost fell off the Golden Boot race, because there was like an injury around those Champions League games where he came back and scored the hat-trick. And then obviously they were knocked out, so they didn't really play much towards the end because there was nothing to play for.
Yeah,
they won
yeah.
the league by February, probably.
Mm.
So that is going to be interesting to balance the squad. We will have to end it there. And I said that was going to be a briefer Serie A section, but it probably ended up being quite long because we did Inter and Juventus. But obviously they kick off this weekend. Sorry we didn't get to La Liga, Mo. You're going to have to...
I had no desire to wear a league.
What do you mean? You're going to have to hope something really special happens this weekend.
Like Adderley scoring an over a kick in there. So that's not special enough for you.
It's okay. Not. No, it's not. And also, it was a week... It's so long ago now. As I said to you, Mo is obviously just written a piece on Barcelona's attack and how broken it is. So if you can't listen to him talk about it, read that at least. But that is the end of the podcast. And remember to download the BetBull app and look at our probably chaotic accumulator again. Sam will not be doing it this week, so that he doesn't misrepresent us. But look out for that at the end of the podcast in the description, and we will catch you next week.
Exorcise the demons.